Well, I got a call from Tony that he has a conflict, and I got a note from Daryl that he can't make it. But anyway,
are you talking about Tony Litvinenko or Tony Sadie?
Sadie. Oh. No, excuse me, Tony Litvinenko. Tony Litvinenko can't make it.
He has dinner with a guy from the Real News Network who's in town.
Yeah.
Victor Lopo.
Judy and Ruth. Anyway, let's get started. We're going to have a discussion on Russia and the Ukraine crisis today. Before we start, let me just do the usual and remind us that in 2 weeks on Sunday, we'll have Tabid Ross talking to us about the Bedouins and their problems in the Negev. A month from about now, Monday the 18th, we have the Iranian professor who's spoken to us a few times about the nuclear deal and what's going on with it. And a month beyond that, we'll have Jeff Cooper talking about the time he was living and working in Ramallah. So remember, I'm open to future Zooms. This is our schedule. We can go beyond that. And again, a call for dues. If we're going to give $100 as we voted to do as an honorarium to our guest hosts, we need the dues. Also, we're coming up. This is the time of the year we have big expenses. We have $150 is our license, is our Zoom license, and about $100 to maintain a website. Anyway, let me just say a few words to start this thing off. This is the map of the Ukraine, and the colors indicate them, as it says in the caption down here, the major languages in each of these provinces. The large letters, the large blue letters are the five or six biggest cities, and the smaller letters are the smaller towns. And the ones that have these pink circles around them are more or less under siege. Mariupol is under terrible siege. Kiev is barely under siege, but that seems to be where they are. So these are where the Russian-speaking people are in these two provinces, what's called the Donbas and what's called the Crimea. The Crimea was, for the past 200 years, it's had 16 or 17 different countries that it controls it. The last change was in 1984 when Khrushchev and the Soviet...
No, Jeff. Khrushchev already died in 84. You're talking about sometime in the 60s.
54.
In 1984, no. Russia gave the Crimea to the Ukraine.
No, it was in, Uri Wright is 54 when Khrushchev was the prime minister.
Okay, it's 64. From the,
Khrushchev was Ukrainian.
And Khrushchev was Ukrainian. The Donbas are these two provinces, and they're shown as all Russian speaking, but actually the Russian speakers are only along about the eastern half of those provinces. I'm not going to say anything about what led up to this conflict. Let me just say that the Russians started the invasion on February 24th. They were stalled by Ukrainian army and resistance. Russia is now occupying the areas sort of along that whole edge. The northeast, the east, and the southeast down to Crimea. And let me just say the siege of Mariupol is described far worse than the siege of Gaza. With that, I am going to end this share And I want to open the discussion to whoever wants to go first. Does anyone care to go first, or should I call on someone? Uri.
Go, okay, Uri. First of all, tell me that you can hear me.
We hear you.
Barely, but we can hear you.
I also made Dick a co-host, so he can mute anybody who hasn't muted themselves.
Uri, why are you always so soft? What is going on for two or three years now? I mean,
there's a bad mic.
But Uri, of all people, go buy a mic.
Get alone, buy a mic. I talk to you once a month. Anyhow, can you hear me?
A mic is $10, Uri.
It's not the issue. Anyhow, can you hear me?
Uri is not poor.
It's not that. Can you hear me or not? Answer.
Sort of, yes.
We Good. Hear you.
Okay. Yes.
So basically, let me give you the first line when I need to give all my friends my position. I said, basically, we, the United States, we pee in the swimming pool, Putin is peeing from the top of the diving board. Other than that, the Ukrainian are the ones who are actually in the swimming pool being peed upon. So this is the way I sum the whole situation in one sentence. So, because at the beginning I heard everybody started telling me that we messed up, we American messed up. And the more you read about it, the more you realize that we had a lot to do with it. But ultimately, nobody asked Putin to jump in and start the war. So that's on his account. But yet we as Americans, we actually in the last 30 years, we have a lot to do with the fact that that situation is happening there. So not to take away the responsibility, because when you look at the whole world, we Americans like to control the world. And one of the things we did after the fall of the Soviet Union, we basically knew the red lines of the Russia and all that, but we kept pushing them because we figured that they were weak. So not to take away anything from them, but we have a big responsibility in the whole mess. The second point I wanted to make, no matter what, the military industrial complex of the United States always makes money. And the proof is like they just got another $14 billion, $7 billion of it is basically to replenish all the equipment we give to the Ukrainian. And Yossip probably remembers in 1973, when the Americans opened their emergency military equipment and they start flying the streets and stuff to Israel from Germany, they basically have enough equipment to put like two divisions with full everything. So that's what they're doing right now. They're sending everything to Germany, and right away they started reproducing to fill it up. So in other words, we always find an angle how to make money out of it, no matter what. Now, this is not something that I'm blaming the Americans, but we have a big responsibility in the mess. And this is one of the things that it's not like black and white. We as Americans, we have a big responsibility to what's happening in Ukraine. So as far as Israel involvement, the whole thing, Israel is trying to do something very interesting. They're trying to pretend that they are going with, but actually going without. In other words, Israel is trying to be in the middle, and any way you cut it, they don't look great, because they're trying to protect their interest, and all of a sudden morality that we Jews always preach to the world disappeared. There's no morality anymore, because we are holier than thou. We can tell the world what they did to us 8 years ago, but when the situation is reversed, all of a sudden there's all kind of consideration about the Jewishness of Israel. And so I just touch on a few points. I'll join later. Go ahead.
Let me ask you one to elaborate on one thing. Isn't China doing exactly what Israel is doing? In other words, bemoaning the plight of the Ukrainians, but refusing to condemn Russia for its war crimes.
Except there's a difference between Israel and China, if you didn't notice, the size and the abilities and a lot of other factors. Israel is a small town in China, population-wise. So, and there's always a saying that what Jupiter can do, his bull cannot. So it might be morally equivalent, but the Chinese can do anything we want. We Israelis have one issue. As soon as the Americans take up the automatic veto in the United States, in the United Nations Security Council, all of a sudden, all bets are off. So up till now, in the last 40 or 50 years, we got it almost automatically. It's not given. So that's the point I want to make about that, comparing us to China. China can do whatever they want.
Yossi, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to deal with a little bit different aspect of this war. Who is Putin? What interest he represent in Russian society and economy? And what ideology try to push he and his people in Russia itself? Maybe I start what I said in the end. When the war started, Putin gave a speech which was basically extreme Russian nationalism.
Hello, sir.
That remind me the right wing Israeli Jews, that he was talking, you know, in Israel they use the expression Eretz Israel Ashlema, the greater Israel, which is go from the sea to the river. And Putin describes it, the greater Russia that include Ukraine. He made very clear to the Russian people that Ukraine is not really a nation. It's actually part of Russia. And the war is the war of fighting fascism against the fascists in Ukraine and using extreme Russian nationalism to justify it and rally the people. And I'm telling you, for somebody who grew up in Israel and few wars, the extreme nationalism is very, very effective tool to rally the people. Suddenly, all the differences between different political parties, between different organizations disappear, and people rally behind this extreme nationalism. You know, somebody show a poll, I think, I don't know for what, and shows that majority of Russian right now as we speak still supporting the war. Also, we know in United States, when United States went to war, you use American nationalism, American jingoism, you know, to rally the society behind you to go to war. This is unfortunately a very effective tool. It was done by other countries. So this is one aspect. Now, I don't know why some people on the left or progressive, call themselves progressive, supporting Putin. Because actually, who is Putin? He represents the interest of the oligarch in Russia. This is what he's surrounded by, and this is his cliques in Russia, and he gives them all the privilege to run the Russian economy. If I can say extreme capitalism in Russia, where rights of workers and civic society have been reduced. So this is what is it, you know, but the extreme nationalism is very effective tool to say, this is why we're going to the war. You know, he even accused, you know, he went all the way back to the history and accused Lenin, that Lenin recognized Ukraine as a national entity. And he said, this is because of Lenin. He is the one responsible to create the Ukraine people. He is the one. And I heard the same argument in Israel. Somebody created the Palestinian people. They never really exist. You know what Golda Meir said. So I found a lot of similarity in the justifications of going and occupied and go to war, and it's still going, you know. The only thing is it's looked like that he didn't plan in his plan a strong resistance by Ukraine army or some of the civilians. And I don't know how many Russian soldiers died, but it's much more than the 489 that was reported a week ago, 10 days ago. So maybe now we're talking about 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, who knows, in very short period for this disaster war, you know, but one thing that I'm getting frustrated with the mainstream media, that right now, this is the only story they're telling you all day long. You don't hear anything else. Nothing, I'm talking about the TV. I can't look at this anymore because they keep saying the same thing. Doesn't matter if you watch CNN, MSNBC, I don't even bother to go to Fox, but they're all day long, this is the only subject, like everything else is gone, nothing. There is no economic problem here. There is no a woman who now have to be confirmed to the Supreme Court. People already forgot it exists. And the issue of nothing happening in the Senate, nothing happening in the House as far as trying to improve the program that Biden brought, you know, it's not even on the discussion anymore. It's like all gone, gone with the wind. It's only Ukraine and that's it, you know. In the same time, the Air Force of Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates still bombarding the civilians in Yemen, but this is also went under the radar. And the Israeli army continued its occupation of 55 years. And this is also, it's not subject to discussions about denying people rights and their democratic rights or national rights and on and on and on. Anyway, so, but because I know some progressive, people who call themselves progressive, that they support Putin. And why a progressive person support a guy that deprive democratic rights, represent the oligarch, the most richest man in Russia on the expense of Russian workers, right? Why people like this supporting him? I just can't get it. What is in him, just because he's anti-US, he's automatically a good guy, you know? Anyway, this is for right now my 2 cents.
Dick, you're muted also.
Well, I agree with Yossi about the media. I have looked, I listen to some NPR. I flip the channels a little bit. Mostly Rachel and I have turned to European news and Al Jazeera. You can watch France 24 and Deutsche Welle. But for a long time on our Roku player, they were cut off. We had to go to YouTube to be able to do it. And it's impossible to get Russia Today. The Russian stations have largely been eliminated. I can still stream it on my phone because I have the app, but I couldn't download the app. So we're subject to a kind of censorship. When you look at Russia Today, it's mostly a discussion of Donbass and the role of neo-Nazis, which I've read a lot about. I mean, there's a horrible history of Nazi collaboration of Ukrainians, especially Stepan Bandera and many of the people around him in World War II and afterwards. But what I have found is there are some really good treatments of the whole history of what goes on, which is different than the media. The media begins the history on about February 24th, which is when the invasion began. So the previous 30 years are eliminated, but I've gone back and I have tried to assemble a timeline. I sent it out to some people and I keep expanding it, which actually I began with something from the Council on Foreign Relations. And then I keep expanding it as I read more things. I fill in a lot of blanks, and I'll talk about that in a second. But anyway, let me
just interrupt and say that Dick's timeline is attached to the announcements.
Yeah, it might be an older version because I keep finding more things. But anyway, this is what I've found from many different perspectives. Something that really goes into the detailed history. The most detailed history was a talk given by Scott Horton from he's the head of antiwar.com, and he goes into a 2-hour history of what happened. And then I found an excellent presentation by John Mearsheimer, who's a professor of international relations at the University of Chicago, jointly with Ray McGovern, who's a retired CIA spy, and they gave a presentation of something called the Salon. I don't know what it is, but it was, and they also had, I think, is it John Matlock, former US ambassador to Russia. It was really excellent. And John Mearsheimer systematically debunks every one of the main talking points that Yossi was complaining about, I think in the media. And then, I found a wonderful detailed history by Abby Martin and Brian Becker, although someone told me YouTube has dropped all of Abby Martin's shows, but I think you can find it. That one is really good. Brian Becker is a left-wing organizer, and he has a program of his own called The Socialist Report or something like that, but he was interviewed by her. Then I found a wonderful thing by Jimmy Dore interviewing Max Blumenthal, and Max did a detailed deep dive into the history of the neo-Nazis. There's many different parties in the Ukraine. They don't do well in the polls, but they've been integrated into the Ukrainian army. And then I heard about a documentary that's kind of hard to find, but it's by Oliver Stone, the filmmaker. It's called Ukraine on Fire. You can find, it's still on YouTube. I was told YouTube dropped it, but to get it on YouTube, I've never been forced to sign in to YouTube to watch something. And then I have to click a disclaimer that the YouTube community has found this to be uncomfortable content or something like that. But it's Ukraine on Fire. If you have to do one thing, I would say watch Ukraine on Fire. So my own view, based on all these variety of sources, is that Putin made the decision, and I agree with Yossi that he represents oligarchs, but Putin didn't drop out of the sky. I mean, the oligarchs were a result of US policy. I mean, when the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991, they call it the Harvard boys, Larry Summers and people like that came in, and they did a shock therapy to remove price controls, any kind of constraints on trade. And the result was a tremendous decline in the standard of living and the creation of a lot of oligarchs. And the same thing happened in the Ukraine. The Ukraine has oligarchs, and Zelensky is represented by oligarchs. And I was shocked to find out that the Azov Battalion and some of the other neo-Nazi militant groups, like their equivalent of the Proud Boys, are funded by Jewish oligarchs in the Ukraine. So my point, this is what I think has happened. I think there's been a battle that the neocons won probably during the Clinton administration to push, to renege on all of the decisions that were made by James Baker and so forth, that NATO wouldn't expand beyond, the Elbe River. During the Clinton administration, it expanded. It now includes 14 countries in Central Europe and Eastern Europe, all of which were either in the Warsaw Pact or part of the Soviet Union. And beginning in 2008, Russia, and it would have been the same with any Russian leader, even if it hadn't been Putin, they said, this is a red line, the expansion of NATO into this area with missiles, with bases and so forth, especially the Ukraine, is our red line. And if you keep pushing, it will have a bad outcome, which has happened. And I think these neocons have continued all the way through every administration, from Clinton all the way to Biden. And their attitude is, we will have U.S. expansion into Central Europe and Eastern Europe, whatever the price. And they disregarded the advice of the Kissinger and George Kennan and William Burns, all the foreign policy experts at the time, who said, this will be a colossal foreign policy mistake. This is, I think, one of the points that Uri was making, that it'll be a blunder. And I've tried to think, well, how will it be a blunder? I mean, we can see that there's a war, and it'll certainly be a blunder for the Ukrainians. I mean, they're suffering. You know, as the saying goes, the U.S. is willing to fight to the last Ukrainian. It will make Russia look bad, because the people in Russia will suffer from the sanctions, and the army will be I don't think it'll be like Afghanistan, but the army will not look weak. And the U.S. and Europe will certainly be weakened. I mean, American consumers will already have $6 gas, and it'll soon be up to $7 or $8, I think. And it'll fuel inflation. And the United States looks weak, and Europeans look weak, because NATO has turned out to be a paper tiger. And I kept thinking, well, who is going to actually come out the winner? And I said, it has to be China. And I didn't go looking for this, but I said, I wonder what's available in English translation from things that are published in Russia. And I found a website that has all kinds of translations from countries all over the world, either English language publications or articles that have been translated into English. And I found someone who writes from a gazette in Moscow, named Popov, and he does a detailed analysis of saying exactly why China will turn out to be the long-term winner. Part of it is the end of the dollar as the reserve currencies. This will drive Russia and China closer together, and the Europeans will suffer because they will no longer be able to get cheap gas and oil from Russia. So I that'll be my final remark. I think China will be the big winner. I think the only way you can get an accurate account of what has happened and what will happen is you have to go searching through YouTube and podcasts. And I'll stop there, and we'll let other people talk.
Joe Avisaw had his hand up. So, Joe?
Yeah, hi. Thank you. You know, I was thinking about the mediation aspect of this conflict. I read today in the New York Times that they named three countries that are mediating or attempting to mediate. Israel, Prime Minister Bennett, and a little bit Lapid also, but Israel, Turkey, and France. They're trying to mediate between Russia and Ukraine. The way I understand mediation, the traditional way of understanding of mediation, is that you have a person that is neutral, that goes around between one side and another and try to elicit as much information as possible, and see and determine whether there is a way to bridge the gap. And they do it by various means, various methods, keeping some of the information secret, etc. But they are neutral. That's the traditional mediator. And then there are those mediators that want to leverage themselves somehow into the conflict. to gain something. The most obvious one that I can give an example would be Kissinger. And after the 1973 war between Israel and Egypt and Syria, Kissinger became the mediator. But he was not only mediating a ceasefire, he was leveraging the United States to become an ally of Egypt and kick the Russians out completely. And ever since then, Egypt and the United States are allies. The United States is supplying arms to Egypt. So he leveraged this conflict in favor of United States interest. He was not a pure mediator. So I don't really know what is Israel trying to leverage? What is Turkey trying to leverage here? And what is France trying to leverage? And why is the United States not trying to mediate? Why is China and other countries are not trying to? So I'm just opening it up for a discussion because there has to be something that they are trying to leverage from this. And maybe you guys can tell me or speculate what it is.
I mean, it's clear why the United States isn't trying to mediate. The United States has been shipping weapons and setting up secret training bases in the Ukraine since 2015, and that came out of the LA Times. I mean, so the United States wants to expand NATO. They want to have a Ukraine that's allied to the United States. They've been trying to push since 2008 to have the Ukraine part of NATO. So why would they possibly want to negotiate? They've been planning, according to what I've read, for a long-term insurgency. Hillary Clinton was saying what happened to the Russians in Afghanistan will also happen in the Ukraine. So that explains why the U.S. won't negotiate.
But the U.S. can lose Ukraine altogether.
Say that again?
The United States could lose Ukraine altogether. In other words,
it's possible. I don't see how it would happen, but it's possible.
But the U.S. never had the Ukraine. I mean, the problem is...
No, I disagree.
Ukraine has been part of the Russian sphere of influence, and the U.S. has tried to break that sphere of influence and get the Ukraine into the West. And during the negotiations before the war, the supposed negotiations between the U.S. and Russia, the U.S. never laid on the table that Russia's sphere of it would never recognize Russia's sphere of influence. And right now the situation, I mean, Dick is right but the question is, how does the thing end now? And I don't really think that they wanted to go on forever, or even if they wanted to go on for a long time, like Hillary Clinton does, they've got to stop the bombarding of the civilian and civilian infrastructure in the Ukraine. And how do you do that? And the only way to do that is to do something that lets Putin have something that he can declare as a win. And that is really establishing that, or recognizing that, the Ukraine is part of Russia's sphere of influence, just like Mexico is part of the United States sphere of influence. What would the U.S. do if Mexico started dealing with Russia?
Can I be the devil's advocate?
Yossi and Uri have their hands up, but we haven't heard from Jack or Julia or Judy or Ruth or Eric. So Eric has his hand up now that he's called on. So Eric.
Okay, well, I think that reference has been made to the fact that gas prices are going up. And I think that It would be foolish as, you know, how shall I say, materialist, I won't say Marxist, but materialist thinkers, scientific, you know, scientific analysts of this situation, not given to excesses of national pride on any side, because we've seen the effects of that. It behooves us to look at this whole energy issue. To me, it is, and by the way, you know, People's World that I write for is just full of insightful articles about Ukraine, Russia, the history, U.S. intentions, NATO. I encourage you all to, you know, pop in every couple days and see if there's something worth reading in there. So I want to acknowledge, you know, my own sources. It is not coincidental that this whole episode broke out just as Nord Stream 2 was nearing completion and going online. I think it was supposed to open in the spring or the summer. Not just as, not the minute before, but, you know, a few weeks or months before. And, you know, to refresh your memory, I'm sure you all know this, Nord Stream 2 was intended. This program has been in construction for years as an agreement between Germany and Russia to bring natural gas to Germany and maybe ship it beyond Germany as well. I'm not sure what the arrangement was. What does this do to the fracking industry in the United States? I mean, we've been hearing about fracking for years here, and energy independence. You know, under Obama, we achieved energy independence. Although when you looked more closely, even during Obama's years, there were snarky people, like people on the left, who said, "What the hell are you talking about? Independence? We're building these pipelines to go to eastern ports, maybe some western ports too, I think, or Texas, to ship the natural gas abroad, sell it. So we have not just independence, but an excess of energy to sell to the world. So just like World War I, and one might be able to say from a totally cynical point of view, you know, the fate of the Jews aside and fascism aside, World War II as well, it's about markets. If Russia was going to sell, you know, a good portion of its energy product, including coal, perhaps including nuclear at some point, gas and oil to Western countries, and, you know, live off that for decades to come, maybe centuries, who knows how extensive those resources are. That's a control of a market that the U.S. energy sector would you know is salivating to get into, and with their control over NATO, you know, they have the power, the muscle to force kind of unwilling countries like Germany, which came on board only very late, really up to the February 24th. I mean, they wanted this cheaper natural gas. Now, when natural gas is shipped from the United States to anywhere, it has to be liquefied first. I hope I'm getting my science right. This is beyond my field. I'm just this is hearsay for me. So the liquefied gas goes into the ships, and they have to build special ports. You can see a map of ports in Europe that have been equipped and updated to accommodate ships that will unload and reconvert liquefied natural gas into the natural gas, which is what the Russians were trying to sell, not liquefied and deliquefied. So this you know, fracked gas from the United States is estimated to be 4 or 5 times more expensive. And Russia is a big producer of oil as well, which means that now we are, still even more intensively in the arms of the Saudis, and even, shocker of all, even reaching out to Venezuela, which we've been demonizing for for decades since Hugo Chavez. I think this goes back to basic struggle for markets of raw goods, and I would go beyond. This is all speculation, of course. So we're doing a certain degree of that here, but I would go beyond what anyone has said up to now, which is to say that one of the reasons that we encourage, through the CIA and many other vehicles, the nationalism of all these republics in the Soviet Union, and encourage them to break out of the Soviet Union. Some of them could have stayed in a greater Euro-Asian Federation or whatever they might have called it. They probably would have been a lot better off, in my opinion. But no, they all split. I think that if you look at the this situation from the perspective that I've been laying out for markets and resources, I think the intention all along has been not just to contain Russia in any of its avatars, czarist, Soviet, now Russian, capitalist Russian, not only to contain, but actually to pick away at it and reestablish the control of Chevron and Shell and Mobil and BP as the commanding forces over the Russian economy and over the Russian energy sector to buy it up or control it or have a controlling interest. And even territorially, I think that they could, that the West could foment national revolutions or uprisings or resistances in a lot of places across that whole. I mean, it's still the biggest country in the world, even despite the fact that it's been shaved down by quite a bit with the departure of all those Soviet republics. There could be military invasions with a weakened Russia. All these sanctions are destined not just to weaken Russia now, but to weaken Russia forever and open up Russia to either invasion, military or commercial, commercial, industrial, corporate. Perhaps even physically dismantle Russia, a Siberian republic, I don't know what the other regions are, a Ural, Republic of the Urals, or who knows, the Republic of the Far East, and I don't put it past. I mean, there's nothing too cynical for capitalism to do. They would do it in a minute if they could, and I think that's what they are trying to do.
You just explain it,
Judy. That was it.
I just wanted to say to Eric. Eric, I saw today that your translation. Congratulations, that the review, the nice review of the book, and did it just come out? Like just like a couple of days ago or something, or did I just read a review?
Well, I don't know. You probably read a review of Border Crossings.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's the fourth in a series of books that I'm translating.
Oh, so you've already translated three. Oh, because they acted in the review like it was the first one, and then you were going to do the rest of them.
I mean, no, four have appeared so far, and there's four more coming.
It's fiction, right?
Fiction, yeah. Thank you for acknowledging that. Off topic here, but
no, I know. Well, it just took a minute to do that. Yeah. Yes. I'm just listening. So go ahead, everybody.
So there's eight books in that series.
Do you know the review I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
It made it sound like this is the first one, but you and the publisher have plans to do all the rest of it. Didn't say that you'd already done three. That would have been something that you might have thought the review would have said.
Right. Well, yeah.
Anyway, okay, congratulations.
Thank you.
Eric, could you just explain it succinctly? How does the West intend to weaken Russia forever?
The sanctions, the diversion of all of this national treasure into war and materiel and losses, and turn the Russian population against Putin. And eventually dethrone Putin, assassinate him, or get rid of him, and form a national council for Russia, which would be a replacement government until we can organize a new government there under the U.S. thumb, U.S. and Western, and I think that Putin's not going to be there forever. No one is, why not weaken him as much as possible now, turn the country against him as much as possible and the world against him, and make them suffer like capitalism made Allende suffer, with their hands around the throat of the Chilean economy.
I think I have a question. Wouldn't this scenario, though, drive Russia closer to China and allow that's what the point I read, that allow China to expand its influence? China is being very careful in this case.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think that the ultimate winner will be China, but not specifically because of this situation. I think it's because although they have a mixed socialist and communist mixed socialist and capitalist economy. I mean, we see a lot of the capitalist aspects of it, multimillionaires in China and so forth. But it's all under tight control of the Communist Party there. And they're very disciplined about it, more so than most countries in the West would tolerate. More so, I would dare say, than even communists from the West, from the rest of the country would tolerate. They're pretty strict. They have their billionaires, but they also tax them at a high rate, so that the wealth from the those billionaires create is plowed back into the countryside, to roads, to technology, so that very soon, if not already, they will surpass not only the United States, but any other country. I think, yes, they will. And the chaos in not only just in the Western countries, but as you have pointed out, Russia is now a Western country. In terms of the capitalist economy, so yes, China is going to benefit from this anarchy and war and competition, and they will come out on top.
Okay, Jack, Ruth, Julia, Judy, do any of you have a comment? Not hearing any. I'm gonna Uri and
I would like. Can I go? Am I called on?
Yes.
Okay. I was wondering what other people think about your comparison of the situation to Israel. I mean, you sent it out and my friend Joel got it, and we haven't really argued in years, but we had a back and forth that was like so vicious and hostile on his part, but he hated your comparison to Israel, and he's supposed to be moderate. I mean, what do other people think about Jeff's comparison to Israel?
Uri.
Okay, so I have a couple. I'm not going to answer you right away, Judy.
Closer to the mic, Uri.
Well, hold it just a second. Can anyone answer Judy right away? Yossi? Eric, you can answer Judy.
Yeah, I agree with you in a certain point. I mean, it's a good question. But I would say, there are comparisons and analogies. You know, nothing is ever perfect or complete or total or self-contained. But I would expand it to the imperialism, if you will, and the suppression of native and indigenous peoples that all of the great countries have engaged in, including the United States. I mean, it is so cynical for us sitting here on Tongva land and Gabrielino land and Chumash land to be complaining about Russian imperialism. The hypocrisy, not only that, but of course, stealing half of our country from Mexico and putting banana republics in Central America and orchestrating coups in Chile and Ecuador, Peru, Honduras, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, just go on and on and on. This is talk about it. This is no longer a world of spheres of influence. That's crazy. The biggest sphere of influence is right here in the Western Hemisphere with the US. So Israel is just one small example of this, but it's a much bigger issue. And the European powers have nothing to complain about either. The Belgians in the Congo, the French all over the world, the British all over the world, Germany had its imperial ambitions. Italy had its imperial ambitions. Spain, Portugal, they have no position to complain about this either.
Yeah, Jeff, why did you limit it to Israel? Just kidding.
Yeah, it goes way beyond Israel.
I think Judy got a point. Why? I'm talking right now about the 21st century and not what happened in the last 100 years. I agree with Eric, all the descriptions. What is the comparison? Russian Putin went to war using extreme nationalism the way it done in Israel. Very similar. I heard the speech, and I know the speeches in Israel were so much similarities. Greater Russia, greater Israel. The Israeli government for the last 54 years, 55 years almost, is completely disregarding international law and occupying the Palestinians for 55 years almost. And every resolution of the United Nations, they completely disregard using the expression shmum. The United Nations is nothing. Of course, with the help of the United States putting veto so many times, I don't even remember the counts of veto in the Security Council. Each time came the issue of the occupation, national rights for Palestinians, on and on and on. So now Russian government under Putin also engaged in violating international law, the sovereignty of Ukraine. Beside all the issue of the gas, whatever, they're violating the sovereignty of a neighbor country. And while the Russian army crossed to Ukraine in a violation of international law, the Israeli Air Force was bombing in Syria with the permission of Putin. People asking, why is there in Israel so much reluctance to criticize Russia? And one of the answers is, there is a deal, unwritten deal between Putin, especially Netanyahu, because they were very close friends, Putin and Netanyahu. And Russia give a green light to the Israeli army, the Israeli Air Force, to bomb Syria anytime they wish. They're doing at least once or twice a week. And they're prohibiting from the Syrian army to use the SA-300 anti-aircraft missiles. In exchange, that Israel will not sell the Patriot missiles to Ukraine. This is what the deal was written in Israeli press about this. You know, don't sell those Patriot missiles to Ukraine, and I'm gonna prohibit from Syria to use their anti-aircraft missiles. And you can bomb the Iranian bases, the Iranian army, the Iranian National Guard as much as you want, and we're not going to intervene. There is a jet fighter of Russian pilots in Syria, and they don't challenge the Israeli pilot each time they cross to Syria. They just don't. And in exchange, they don't sell these Patriot missiles, you know, the Iron Dome, what they call it, you know.
Yeah,
so you got now two countries, two governments, they engage on violating international law. He said, what about other countries? Yes, but progressive in Israel specifically made this comparison why they oppose the occupation of West Bank and Gaza and why they oppose the occupation of part of Ukraine right now. As far as what Putin's goal, you know, in order to mediate, you have to know what Putin's goal in Ukraine, what he actually he want, where is what is his goal? The goal is to overthrow, I assume, the Ukraine government and establish a government like in Chechnya. After they destroyed Chechnya and leveled the city of Grozny, they put a puppet regime in Chechnya. It's not only the US that put puppet regime, also the Imperial Russia also doing it in Chechnya, they did it. And they even use Chechen soldiers now in Ukraine, you know, using them as a meat cannon to die in Ukraine. So this is where the, you know, violation of international law, occupation, all this ring a bell very much in Israeli progressive movement, as far as what is the similarity. This is why it was brought, this idea, where is today, now, as we speak, is the comparison, you know, between them. You know, I heard what, by the way, Eric said. And, you know, before the war started, I told Tirza, my wife, I don't think that Putin gonna invade Ukraine. It's absolutely insane because they're gonna lose all the business that you mentioned, the gas to Europe. I assume they predicted, he's not stupid, that there will be a sanctions. United States threatened with sanctions. So why to go to this, an absolutely insane act that only going to weaken Russia? They are get weakened, of course. So why in the world? It sounds like he may be an agent of United States, a secret agent, right? Putin is doing exactly what you said. Some people in the US would like to see Russia to be weakened. So why in the world he did it? I assume he was so much consumed with Russian nationalism, like the Israeli leaders, that they became blind. What is really worth it, you know? When you go again to another war and to go to another war, you know. But I admit I was maybe naive about Putin. Why in the world you went and send 150 or 200,000 soldiers, many of them are so young, who are dying now as we speak in this, you know. You know how the war started, but you don't know how it's gonna end. You don't know how it's gonna end, you know. But one thing, Ukraine is gonna be very weak and destroyed, and Russia is gonna be very much weakened. And the military industrial complex make a lot of money from this war, you know, from selling weapons, you know. And China is looking around. China, their economic interest is the number one interest. This is why I say they will never invade Taiwan, because it's not in the interest of economic interest of China to invite and go to a war. They want to be friends with everybody. They're doing business in Israel also, China. A lot of business. They want to be friends with everybody. It doesn't matter who you are. Just let cut the business, and this is what they do, you know? So they're watching from the side. They don't want to condemn Russia because they have business. They don't want to support the invasion also. So they're just watching. But let me just put another aspect that I feel I need to say it. When we see the Israeli Air Force bombing Gaza and Lebanon and killing civilians, especially in Lebanese war in 1982, they killed 15,000 people there in 1 month. Not too many people know about this, mostly civilians. We were outrageous. We went to the street and demonstrated. For some reason, I feel that this issue of human suffering, whatever we think about the Ukraine government, about their opportunism and the neo-Nazi groups in Ukraine or whatever, but there is a human aspect that we cannot ignore. When the Russian Air Force and artillery bombing and killing civilians, as a progressive people, we cannot be silent about this. Like we're not silent about killing civilians in Gaza, killing civilians in Lebanon and whatever. And when the US Air Force killed people in Vietnam, civilians, we were outraged. But I feel that when it comes to this is not the wars that United States invaded Russia. It's the Russian army under Putin command invaded, and they do these atrocities. And we have to take a stand on this. Otherwise, we'll be like we are selective. And we can ignore this. You know, they're going atrocities else. I'm not there, but you know, it's not too difficult today. And you have a peace movement in Russia, right? They go to a demonstrations and thousands get arrested of demonstrating against the war. Who is these people? They're not agents of the United States. They are Russian who believe that this war is insane and they don't want to be part of it. And this is good. They have some progressive in Russia who are coming out and demonstrating against this war, you know? And we, you know, there was a letter of 250 progressive Israelis to the Russian peace movement and tell them we fought against occupations like you do, and we send solidarity to you. You know, I think it has to be done also by American progressive to those people in Russia, because right there, as soon as you go to the street, you get arrested. You can't even speak, you know? Okay.
Uri.
So I have a few responses to a few points that were made. First of all, Eric, I want to challenge you. You see, I was trained as an economist. And I view everything through the issue of money and economics. So it took the United States 30 years to establish a market, a modern market in Russia. What's the economic interest of the United States to destroy it like that? There's no sense. Another element in the whole thing, we are trying to replace the Russian oil because the United States is the number one producer of oil in the world. If the prices double up, all our oil companies are doing very well, thank you very much. We'll start another war for that purpose. So the whole idea that we did it in order to get the Russian, it might be a tertiary consideration, but we lost a huge market of consumers who want to get everything. So I challenge that point. What's going to happen as far as the energy prices in the world? One thing I learned in economics, the price is higher, the consumption goes down. So in other words, if we're going to have $10 a gallon in the United States or all over Europe, we're going to consume less of it. So ultimately, the law of unintended consequences is going to cause us to use less, which is actually good for the globe, generally speaking. I don't think that anybody intended, but that's the law of the unintended consequences. Sometimes you get something good out of it. Now, Yosef asked about neutral people who can be mediators. There's no such thing. everybody has got an angle and everybody has a background and history. So the issue of finding an honest negotiator or honest doesn't exist. The issue is really interests. And the issue, we have to figure out what's the interest of Russia. Right now, there's a lot of speculation, but it's not clear. And they talk about if they give him part of the Donbass and the Eastern, and we might give him access to the Black Sea, and we give him a little bit of the North, we can settle with Putin because that's what he wants. And they give them Crimea and they declare it's yours and we end the war. I heard that speculation. I have no idea if it's going to happen or not. This is one of the ideas. They said this is his off-ramp to get off the war. Somebody asked the question, how come people are seeing whatever they're seeing? People used to, especially the American TV, to choose sides. This is like Hollywood, the good guys and the bad guys, the white head and the black head, or you choose your team that you want. And that's how people view the world and view the whole conflict, including this one. So everybody basically chooses a side, and because of whatever, he favors that side. It doesn't have to be rational. Most of our people in the world are not rational. I'd say that 80% at least are not acting rationally. Now, Yossi, with regards to the Patriots and the Iron Dome, first of all, it's two different systems. Israel cannot send even one unit because Israel has a very strict licensing agreement with the United States with regard to Patriot and regards to the Iron Dome. There's no way, even if Israel wanted to do that, they cannot. So that's kind of like. Now, one of the cynical remarks that I heard recently was, for the first time in 50 or 75 years, the American information and the CIA and the analysts actually told the truth for the first time ever. They were the only one who said Putin is gonna invade. Everybody like us did the analysis, say it doesn't make sense for him to do it. He's gonna get beat. People say, for the first time, the United States information system was right. They said that they told the truth. So this is kind of a cynical answer, but it's an interesting point. When I heard it, I said, oh yeah, because in 2003, when we invaded Iraq, our information was misleading. I still remember, what's his name, sitting with the file in the United Nations with George Tenet the ambassador, anyhow.
Colin Powell?
I'm sorry?
Colin Powell?
Colin Powell in the front, and behind him was George Tenet, the CIA, and ambassador, what's his name? I got his name.
Well, actually, behind him was Negroponte.
That's the name I was looking for. Yeah, Negroponte.
So Colin Powell asked that the Guernica painting have a cover in front of it.
Okay. Now, just to make another point, we basically, we the nice people, tell Russians, don't dare bomb civilian population. First of all, Israel did it in Beirut in 82. But that's the side. We, the Americans, what did we do in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? We killed, I don't know, 250,000 civilians to stop a war. So who are we to say to anybody in the world, don't drop bombs and kill civilians? We don't have a stand in America. We can shut up and say nothing about it. I mean, I don't justify either one, by the way. It's not a justification. But this is an issue that I always say, wait a second. This is like the stove calling the kettle black. We dropped two atomic bombs. We killed 250,000 civilians. The Russians, yeah, they killed, I don't know, 10,000, 20,000. It's not, in other words, it's not justified either way. I'm not justifying, but I'm saying the proportionality of the whole thing escapes people. So the fact that we actually wanted to depress the competition of Russia. Russia was never really a competition. The only thing that they might have been a competition was the oil. Other than that, it's a terrific market. Just think about it. Boeing sold for hundreds of billions of dollars airplanes and parts to Aeroflot. Same thing Airbus. They cannot sell it even one part. So that means Aeroflot before too long is not going to be able to fly. Otherwise, their planes are going to fall from the sky. So the whole contention that the United States kind of like did it in purpose, I don't think so. I don't think that we're that sophisticated to be able to do an economic situation to change the balance of the economics. Because yes, the oil companies here are going to make a lot of money. But think about all the other 300 or so American companies that don't do business with Russia anymore, like that. So watch out when you talk about that really this is the issue. I don't think so. I challenge that thing. Now, just something that struck me and convinced me that there's going to be a war, which happened a few days. There were 2 points. They showed a couple of days before that a yacht that was moved from a Hamburg shipyard to Kaliningrad. And they said, this is one of the ships that belonged to Putin. Then I knew it became serious. And the other thing is the United States says part of the contingency of the Russian army, they have cremation unit. In other words, they are serious about starting the war and being able to cremate their own. They don't retrieve them, they don't bury them, they cremate them. These are the two things that convinced me like a week before the war started or a few days before that it's serious. It's gonna happen in spite of the fact that it didn't make sense for Putin to do this. Thank you for listening.
I wanted to mention two things. First thing is the point that Yossi raised about the US peace movement, and I've thought a lot about that as well. So far, I've only seen one demonstration that took place at CNN's office in Hollywood, and it was almost entirely composed of, based on the people waving Ukrainian flags, and I'm guessing by the appearance of the people, they were mostly Russian and Ukrainian immigrants to Los Angeles. I've never heard of any demonstrations comparable to those that I've seen in Europe. And I think it's a bit of a bind for the progressive anti-war elements in the United States, because on one hand, yes, they totally empathize with the destruction that's taking place in the Ukraine, but they have access to the whole history of what led up to it. And they don't, the last thing they want to do is align with NATO and align with the neocons and align with the CIA and the color revolutions, you know. So there's a horrible baggage that comes with it. So I think most of the people, like Medea Benjamin, she's been doing a lot of writing. They're sitting on their hands right now. And I think it would be good if people could figure out a way to be anti-war without being pro-US or without coming off as being pro-Putin on the other side. And I don't know that too many people have found it. I've read stuff in The Nation. I've read stuff in a few other publications like John Mearsheimer and all these various podcasts and YouTube things that I referenced where they try to thread the needle, but it's extremely difficult. And I don't know how that'll end up. The other thing is, this is for Uri. I would be a little cautious about using this word we all the time. I think we live in a highly stratified society, and I don't think we have much to do with the government, foreign policy or the oil companies. But I do think that the United States will come out of this looking weak because they can't intervene militarily. You know, they can cheer on the sidelines, they can send weapons. I think Congress has just passed some legislation that they're gonna go send $13.4 billion in weapons. And the lady who played a big role in the Maidan coup in 2014. Victoria Nuland, a neocon in the State Department, who's married to what's his name?
Kagan.
Kagan, yeah, Jeff Kagan. That. I hear a dog or something. I'm not sure. Okay. So, anyway, they're very good at egging on the Ukrainians. They have mastered the art of egging on the Ukrainians. But hold on. But they can't intervene. And then in the end, they'll look very weak because I mean, you don't really achieve much by simply sending weapons or training Ukrainians for paramilitary resistance and sending them to different training camps in the south or sending CIA operatives to the Ukraine to train people. In the end, they look weak. And I'm not sure, you know, this thing that the oil companies will do well. Well, that's, yes, I think that's absolutely true. But on the other hand, it'll take a while, but I think that from what I've read, the Chinese will make more and more offers to the Russians to import their oil and their gas, but they're going to say, we want a discounted price. So for the Russians, they'll find a market, and for the Chinese, they'll find a discounted price. I mean, the Chinese are going to support the Russians, but they're not going to do it unless it works out for them politically and financially as well. So, those are my thoughts. I don't know, maybe someone else knows how the peace movement can be opposed to what's happening in the Ukraine without coming down on the side of Biden and all the other neocons in Washington and both parties.
I have a
before answer. Hold it, Yossi, before okay. You start, I wanna again go to Julia, who hasn't said anything.
Okay.
Can't see you, Julia. We only see your glasses.
Okay. Now, can you see me?
Yeah, now we can see you.
Okay. Look, I think that what you say, Dick, about the decline of the United States is very true. And I think the United States will continue to decline in power and influence around the world. It might take a number of decades, but it's going to happen. And one of the people who I'm influenced by that is Chalmers Johnson in his Blowback trilogy. And his saying that basically we're sort of like the decline of the Roman Empire. Our democracy is very, very flawed. The Roman Empire, they lost their democracy anyway. We have these imperial presidents, and we waste a lot of money on things like the Vietnam War and stuff like that, which we lose, you know. So I think Thomas Johnson is very right about the decline of the West. I think, you know, this Ukraine situation, as you said, the United States can't do much except give arms to the Ukrainians, you know. And I think also Russia might be able to look at most of Eastern Ukraine is Russian speakers. I have cousins from Kharkov. They came a long time ago to the United States, but those are mostly Western speakers, right? And if Russia gets or an independent nation or quasi-independent nation in Eastern Ukraine, that's okay with me. Those are, you know, those are Russian speakers. They're closer to Russia than they are to the Ukraine. I don't care. But so I think the Ukrainian thing might calm down in about a month or so pretty quickly. And Russia might find out that they should make a deal and, you know, have a peace deal, and then we'd be out of it. That's it.
But to make a peace deal, you need peace. You got to have the U.S. agree to it and not keep pushing the Ukrainians to fight. And making a deal means that there'll be that Ukraine is going to be recognized under Russia's sphere of influence, and the U.S., as several people pointed out, don't want to do. Isn't about to do that.
Well. There are people who are saying the solution is like Finland, Sweden, Austria, where the Ukraine would basically be unaligned with either bloc. There are models that would happen, but you would, from what I understand, what led up to this invasion was the breakdown of negotiations. There were negotiations that took place in January where Russia said, you know, these are our red lines. We want you to offer no Ukrainian membership in NATO, no bases, no weapons, and so forth. And the US was absolutely resolute. We won't do it. We won't put any of this in writing. These are unacceptable terms for an off-ramp. So that's what, so whether the US would now agree to it, I think it's doubtful. I think it's gonna, I don't, Julie, I don't see any way that it would quiet down in a month. Mearsheimer and his analysis, he's very critical of the media, but he says once this starts, it's gonna last for a long time and the Ukraine is gonna get leveled. He thought the Ukraine is gonna get destroyed in this process.
I think Dick's right. The US will not allow that, does not want the Ukraine to be in a Russia sphere of influence. And it just wouldn't do it in those negotiations, and it won't do it now. Yossi.
Can I say something?
Julia.
The Ukraine and Russia have been together in the same sphere of influence for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. There was a historically Russian Ukraine, Kharkov was the capital, a Russian in the area of Ukraine, Rus, from about 600 to 1000 AD. So they've been together for a very long, long time, you know. So for the United States and its arrogance, say you can't have a part of, you know, Eastern Ukraine be part of, you know, independent country or close to Russia is the height of arrogance. I don't know how we're going to get away with that kind of stuff. You know, it goes away, it goes against a 1500 year history of that area, right?
Well, I agree with you, Julia, but as Dick said before, we're going to protest, resist that until the last Ukrainian is standing.
There's already 2.5 million refugees. I've heard it might go up to 10.
Almost 3 million already. Mm-hmm.
Ukraine is going to be destroyed. There's no doubt about it.
I agree with you, Julia. That's what, you know, the whole thing is the U.S. got to accept that the Ukraine is in some sphere of influence. It's sort of to Russia like Mexico, I think of as to the U.S. And the U.S. doesn't want to do that. And maybe it's because of things that Eric said, and maybe it's because of other things. But it looks pretty horrible to me.
Putin, Russia have more conditions that remind me again, Israel. One of his conditions, which is the Israeli government also, they're saying that the Palestinian states have to be demilitarized, no army. Only Israel can have an army. But the Palestinian could not have. One of Putin's condition is that Ukraine have to be demilitarized. No army in Ukraine.
No U.S. bases, no foreign bases.
They said Ukraine, I saw the speech that Putin said that Viktor sent me. And I read the whole speech. And he's talking about demilitarize Ukraine. No army in Ukraine. In other words, you cannot dictate to a sovereign government, to a sovereign country, even if you don't like its government, to dictate. As far as the Eastern Europe, you know, when Soviet Union fell apart, they all agree, all the 15 republics, that they will all respect the last borders that have been breaking up, that the borders between different republics considered to be the last borders and not to start fighting. The first fight that started over the border was Armenia invaded Azerbaijan in order to get some area called Nagorno-Karabakh, and was a bloody, bloody conflict. This was the first violations of this agreement. The second violation is when Putin, like Israel, annexed Crimea, like Israel annexed Golan Heights. This is another comparison, and East Jerusalem, claiming that this is an historic place for Israel, so therefore they have a right to annex. It doesn't matter that majority of the people in Crimea are Russians. You have many countries that in certain area, people are, you know, in California, you have in Los Angeles, majority Latinos. So Mexico can come and said, I want to annex Los Angeles because majority are Latinos. There is no end to this. France can say, I want to annex Quebec because majority are French there. So I want to annex Quebec. This is not, you have some norm in this world is sovereignties and borders of countries. When you start violating this and using nationalism, then it's endless war. You know, Julia, you might say it's okay with you, but maybe it's not okay with a sovereign country of Ukraine. Even I despise the government of Ukraine. So what? This is not the issue. You know, Kurdistan in Iraq is part of Iraq. Majority are Kurds, but it's part of the sovereign country of Iraq. Same thing in Syria. North part of Syria is majority Kurds, although the Turks from NATO expelled 200,000 of them where NATO was silent about this, you know. But this how the many countries in the world is functioning. They have certain part of their country, a minority majority in certain geographical area. But you cannot use a war, with all the respect, you cannot use a war in order to resolve this. And this is what Putin tried to do. I'm going to use my mighty power, my mighty army, in order to resolve this and to impose this. It's not going to work. It's look like that the Russian army have a big problem in Ukraine. I don't know the motivation of the Russian soldiers. When you invade another country, like many American soldiers in Vietnam didn't have the motivation to fight. They're shooting their own officers. They were getting drunk. They're getting drugs just to avoid to go to the battle.
That was only the last couple of years.
Young soldiers, Russians, I assume, many of them very unhappy to go and try to occupy another country. I have been there. I was an occupying soldier. I remember how many soldiers didn't really want to be there, you know. So we have to also, as a progressive people, to remember those principles also, beside the big picture of oil and power and influence and all this, that there are certain principles that exist that if we ignore it, so we are not better, you know? You know, as soon as you're violating the sovereignty of another country, you become another schmuck in this world, you know? And Putin is a big schmuck. Besides, he's a reactionary, he's not a progressive, although some people maybe think, you know? But he's another, it's like a World War I. What was the war of World War I? Between different imperialist countries, and no one of them was the good guys versus the bad guys. There were bad guys fighting for influence and money and killed 15 million people in this process of World War I, you know? Until Lenin decided, I don't want to be part of it, I'm quitting this war, you know, in 1917 after the Russian Revolution. He quit this. He said, we have nothing to do with this war. You know, and I believe, you know, you mentioned, Dick, what is the peace movement here? If you oppose the occupations of the Palestinian land and make picket line about this, you can say, I have nothing to do with the US, I have nothing to do with NATO, I oppose the war of aggression of Russia and its occupations, I call for a ceasefire, and we believe that the Russian forces have to go back to the international border. And then go and have a peace talk about this. But this is where, if you're in a peace movement in the US, a progressive one, this is what you have to say. Stop the war right now, get out of Ukraine, and go to negotiate to resolve some of your differences in peace negotiations, but not to impose your will as Putin tried to do it.
Right. Well, I looked up exactly what the Russian conditions are. This came from Dmitry Peskov, who is the Russian press spokesman, about 4 or 5 days ago. He said, He says Peskov said Ukraine must cease military action, change its constitution to enshrine neutrality, acknowledge Crimea as Russian territory, recognize the separatist republics of Donetsk and Lugansk as independent territories. There's nothing about demilitarization.
I saw a Putin speech, and I can send to you.
Okay.
They sent to me.
Well, this is what the latest thing
okay,
is.
Okay, but he,
so this is their opening position. This is, I mean, people negotiate. They don't.
They militarize Ukraine was a Putin speech.
This has been dropped then.
Huh?
It appears that this was dropped. They said neutrality. Maybe. Neutrality doesn't mean demilitarization.
You know, and you cannot tell another country change your constitutions. Maybe Russia have to change their own constitution also to allow.
Well, okay. So if that's the position, then this war will continue. I mean, that's very obvious. It's not so complicated.
Well, this is, it's not for me, but what I'm saying is I think Putin have a goal in this war and he want to achieve the goal. Doesn't matter what the price of Russian soldiers, and Ukraine civilians. He want to overthrow the government in Ukraine to put a pro-Putin government there. And he have difficulties in these goals because he completely miscalculated the resistance in Ukraine. He miscalculated. They stuck there. They wanted to occupy Kiev in 4 days and it didn't work. So he cannot now quit and said, okay, sorry, it didn't work, I'm going home. He's not gonna go home.
No, he'll continue, there's no doubt about that.
Huh?
That's why John Mearsheimer says the Russians will continue based on how all large powers act to pursue what they perceive as their interests, they will continue, you could have argued the same way that the U.S. had their logical reason to withdraw from Afghanistan about 18 years ago, or they could have done it at any point along the way, but they just continued to escalate at every point.
he can't just take the tail between his leg and leave.
No, he won't. I mean,
so
the question is, what is there some way to find an accommodation between what the U.S. is, will the U.S. back down? I don't know. Will the Ukrainians back down? I don't know. Will Putin back down? I mean, without all three players backing down, I can't see that there's any off-ramp for this war.
But, you know, at least as a progressive person, I say ceasefire and don't bomb cities in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Right? They're bombing cities, and this cannot be hide. The whole world is watching it. For God's sake, this is what the B-52 did in North Vietnam, bombing cities in order to bring them to their knees. It didn't work, but meantime, I read between 1965 to 1968, they killed 182,000 civilians in North Vietnam from this bombing. Only these casualties.
From 1968 to 72, the United States dropped twice the number of all the tonnage of bombs in Europe.
But I'm talking about the civilian casualties from the bombing. So you got enormous civilian casualties from this bombing, right? You were bombing cities.
Yeah.
You know, this is a military tactic. You bomb cities in order to demoralize the people and bring them to their knees. It's one of the ugly part of a war of occupations, that this is how you submit people by bombing, and then people are running away as much as they can and maybe giving up. I don't know. But unfortunately, this was done before, and I hope it's not going to be done in the future, but I don't know. I'm not sure about this now.
Uri and then Victor.
Okay, so I have a few comments.
No, Uri first.
I have a few comments to add. First of all, the history is replete with empire that collapsed because to run an empire cost money. So Putin can say he's gonna fight till doomsday. The problem is what he's doing cost a lot of money, tons of money, 200,000 people fighting. I don't have the numbers, but it's probably in the billions on a daily basis. So essentially, he's going to run out of money. Even if he wants to destroy the whole Ukraine, he's going to carpet bomb them and all that thing. At a certain point, you have to replenish your ammunition, your fuel, your food, your material, your people, and all that. So that's actually going to tell you that this war is actually going to be limited, if not by negotiation, by economics. Very simple. We, the Americans, by the way, Dick, when I say we, I mean the United States. I understand.
This group.
We, the Americans, we had deep pockets when we fought Vietnam. And that's really, by the way, in my opinion, one of the reasons that dropped us from a rich country to a also-ranked country. The 10 years or 12 years that we fought in Vietnam, it cost us tons of money. And as if we didn't learn the whole thing, we spent that more money in Iraq and Afghanistan. Putin is going to learn the hard way. He thought that he had a $650 billion war chest. Half of it is frozen. He has to buy parts and all that thing. So it's a whole lot faster than that, even before if they do any negotiation. So that's one thing I wanted to add. Now, another anecdote to add to what Yossi said. A day or two after the Putin started the war, the Israeli ambassador in Moscow was summoned to the foreign ministry. And in so many other words, the deputy foreign minister told him, now, we Russians, we are not going to raise the issue of your occupation of the Golan and the fact that you're settling the Golan against the 1949 Geneva Convention. I hope that you understand it. And I think that actually gave the Israeli the perspective that, ooh, we don't want to pick a fight with them about the occupation of 67 and all that, because that might not work for us and we might not look very nice. So that's another reason, amongst others, why Israel is neutral in the whole thing. Because Israel realizes the same way, the stove doesn't call the kettle black, it's dangerous. So that's the two points I just wanted. Oh, there's another point. After the war, somebody has to rebuild Ukraine. Who's going to do it? American companies, German companies? It's not bad to have war. You destroy, you start rebuilding. Look what happened to Japan after 45. Look at what happened to Germany after 45. We might actually, at the cost of the last Ukrainian standing, that's one thing that America is very good at. We are going to fight till the last Ukrainian standing, like you said, Dick. After that, good for business. We're going to rebuild the whole thing. Thank you.
Chinese companies come rebuilding.
Yeah, a lot of them will probably.
Well, but Uri has a good point. I mean, if the only way that I can see for this thing to end is for the Ukraine being under sort of an umbrella of Russia. And if it's under a Russian umbrella, the West will not rebuild it. Anyway, Victor, you got to unmute yourself. We don't hear you because you're muted.
You have to unmute, Victor. Unmute.
I think he doesn't want to talk to us. Okay.
We don't hear a word you're saying.
Okay.
Maybe there's a way we can. I'm telling him he has to unmute. There's some icon that says unmute. There you go.
There you go.
There you go. I'm sorry, I didn't know. I'm not a computer player. For me, it's difficult to be in a computer. My wife has to help me with the computer. Thank God that she helped me a lot. No, I don't want to be part of the conversation. So I don't want to convince nobody because I don't need to convince. It's nobody to be convincing. Everybody has his own political, going for years, in generation. And nothing has been accomplished. And we continue talking. I like to hear from you, your opinion, and that satisfies me. That's all.
Okay. Anybody else want to want to say anything. Then I'm going to call the meeting closed, and I'll just go back to reminding people about what's coming up. Give me a second to do this. So in 2 weeks, on Sunday, we have, how do you pronounce his name, Yossi?
Dr. Tabet Aburas. Tabet.
Anyway, Sunday, March 27th at 10 o'clock about the Bedouins. Then a month later, on Monday, April 18th at 7 o'clock about the Iran deal. And the following month, Monday at 7 o'clock, the 16th of May, Jeff Cooper. Anybody who has suggestions for future Zooms, let me know. And again, a call for dues would be helpful, because we're running, in the next few months, we have $250 of expenses.
Jeff, can you send me again the information how to transfer money via Zelle? Because you had this option now, right?
Yes.
You have to log into your bank and do it through the bank online.
Yeah, if your bank has it, you can do it.
Yeah, but I need the email, the phone number, or
yeah,
what?
Yeah, it's patentjeff@keyway.net.
Is this your regular email or something different?
That's my regular email, and that's my PayPal address, my Venmo address, and my Zelle address. Okay, guys, we thank you very much. I've learned a lot myself on this conversation. I hope other people have also. And let's hope the bombing of civilians stops. That's the most important thing from a progressive point of view, I think.
Yes.
Yes.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Okay, bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.